This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Schizophrenia is a mysterious illness. Symptoms include hallucinations and sometimes feelings of paranoia or persecution. There are treatments, but there's still a long way to go. New research that appears in the Journal of Neuroscience might shed light on at least one aspect of the illness, auditory hallucinations, hearing voices. Joining us now to talk about this is Richard Mooney. He is one of the authors of the article in the Journal of Neuroscience and a neurobiologist at Duke University School of Medicine. Rich, welcome back. Good to have you.
Frank, nice to be here.
Also joining us, John Gilmore, Vice Chair for Research and Scientific Affairs in the Department of Psychiatry at UNC Chapel Hill. John, welcome. Good to have you here.
Well, thank you.
Richard, tell us about this discovery. What have you uncovered here?
Well, Frank, there's a wealth of literature in humans and other animal models that show that motor systems somehow talk to the auditory system at multiple levels, all the way from the auditory periphery, all the way up to the auditory cortex, that somehow motor systems instruct the auditory system to be prepared. Watch out, something loud's going to happen. That happens during speech, during musical performance, when we can anticipate a noise that we might make or maybe somebody else might make.
Yeah, and the signal is, hey, that guy, you know, his jaw is flapping, the larynx are moving, tongue's wagging, settle down, mute, because it's going to be too loud. He's right there at your ears. And then open up, because Rich is sitting across the table from me. And so the ear is much smarter than that microphone on my video cam.
Right. Many people have been fooled by that same effect. And that ability of our brain to predict the consequences of our motor commands is fundamental, not just to hearing, but to all aspects of sensation and perception, really.
All right. But as you say, we've known that. So what's new in your discovery?
Well, what's different or new is actually describing the physical instantiation of how it's done, or at least the nuts and bolts of it. I mean, it's a little bit like knowing that the moon is up there in the sky. We can see it, as opposed to actually walking on it. In this study, we were able to really get down to the level of the connections between the motor cortex and the auditory cortex that we think is a major channel for conveying information at that level. And that relates in a speculative way to the kinds of interactions that are thought to be important for, you know, dysfunction that relates to auditory hallucination, for
right.
example.
So tell us about that, because obviously that sheds light on how it works when it's working well. It calms down or mutes the sound of my own voice in my head. But auditory hallucinations, what's the connection between this and that, hearing things, hearing voices?
My understanding is that in florid psychotic states and schizophrenics, for example, there can be an increased auditory hallucination concomitant with speaking. So when the individual is talking, there's an elevation in the amount of auditory hallucination, and there's the phenomenology itself. People don't experience abstract sounds so much as they experience voices and complex sounds. Mice obviously don't speak in the sense that we do, and it's not clear that the schizophrenic models that exist in transgenic mouse lines or mutant mouse lines suffer from auditory hallucinations per se, but that high-level aspect of auditory hallucination implicates interactions between motor cortical regions important to speech production and the auditory cortex.
Yeah, that's interesting, John. So let's talk about this, and probably we should talk about what schizophrenia is and the relationship, if any, the symptom of hearing voices, auditory hallucination.
Right. Auditory hallucinations are a common symptom in people who have schizophrenia. About 70% of people who have schizophrenia will have auditory hallucinations. You can have hallucinations in any sensory modality. So you can have visual hallucinations, gustatory, sensory, all kinds of hallucinations. Other symptoms of schizophrenia include paranoia, other kinds of delusions. People who have schizophrenia also tend to have what we call negative symptoms, and so they tend to be more withdrawn. They may not experience pleasure as readily as a normal person might. They're maybe more asocial.
So you say 70% of people with schizophrenia have experienced auditory hallucination. Do you hear voices and not have schizophrenia? Is that also a possibility?
Sure. I mean, I think everybody's heard a voice every once in a while, and I know that I sometimes hear my voice called. So an auditory hallucination is a symptom. It's not, you know, it's not schizophrenia. You can have hallucinations in a lot of different kinds of illnesses.
And, of course, the distinction here is we hear voices in a sense all the time. When we talk to ourselves mentally, we can go over a conversation. We can even try to bring new information to ourselves in our own voice. Mm-hmm. And, of course, when we're healthy, the key is we know where that's coming from. We know it's not from the outside world.
Right.
And so the problem is when you can't make that distinction, right?
Right, right. And I think, you know, with people who have schizophrenia and have auditory hallucinations, there are people that have insight into their hallucination. They know that it's not, you know, it's not real. It is being generated inside their head. And then there are people who don't have that appreciation, that can't make that distinction. And that's one of the more interesting things about, you know, why can some people do it and other people can't.
And Rich said something else that I guess I had never really considered. You know, I've heard the term auditory hallucination. Of course, we use the phrase hearing voices for a long, long time. But those hallucinations tend mostly to be voices, that we don't hear other sounds, other hallucinations about sounds that are not really happening in the outside.
Yes, I think that's what most people report. But I do have patients that will hear music sometimes, or they'll hear other kinds of sounds. But voices are very common.
So tell us about this. What do we know about in terms of treatment for schizophrenia mm-hmm. right now? What's available?
Well, the mainstay of treatment are antipsychotic medications, and they are all medicines that block dopamine receptors, and they tend to be reasonably effective at treating the positive symptoms. So they are reasonably effective in treating the hallucinations and the paranoia and delusions in schizophrenia.
How do they work? And what regions of the brain are affected by those medicines?
There's a lot of theories about that. And, you know, the mainstay is the dopamine hypothesis of schizophrenia, which posits that there's an overactivity of dopamine systems in the brain, maybe especially subcortical, that associated with the psychosis, and dopamine, the antipsychotics tend to block that activity. But the antipsychotics that we use also affect all different kinds of receptors and all different parts of the brain. So it's a general way of thinking about it, but there's a lot of unknowns about how these medicines work.
Rich, if you work backward, now that we know that there's this motor kind of conversation between, oh, his mouth is moving, tongue's wagging, it's him talking, right? It you know, the brain is saying, that's Frank, just relax. Could that be the part that's broken down then in the schizophrenic that allows for this auditory hallucination, that we're not getting enough information about who it is that's making the sound?
Well, I think just as John was pointing out, sometimes we hear sounds that probably aren't there. They sound compelling. So our brain can do that sort of thing spontaneously. And we use it, just as you alluded to, in kind of visualization or auditory visualization, in this case, of consequences of motor performance. I play music. I'll imagine playing a piece even when I don't have the instrument in my hand. That's actually very, very powerful. That's normal function. But if there's spontaneous activity in a motor cortical region that accidentally trips off activity in the auditory cortex, and it does it in a repetitive and pathological way, that ultimately can drive this kind of higher order.
Well, could that mean then that there's something that I do that is confused with speaking? So, for instance, you know, scratching the back of my ear was confused by the brain as sort of the speech mechanism, and now I'm conflating two signals.
Well, that's an interesting idea. I think that's possible, that there's a misrouting of motor command signals, but it's also possible that there's spontaneous activity in motor command areas. These are very high-level planning areas. They don't necessarily always engage movement. The motor cortex could be active and not result in movement, for example. And if that signals the auditory cortex, it could result in the sensation of, I've just spoken, when I haven't said anything at all.
And when you talk about motor cortex, of course, that's the place in the brain where motor or movement signals are taken, right? So we're talking about the place in the brain where movement is registered.
Well, where motor planning, especially in humans, is kind of figured out in great detail. But, you know, again, going back to what we found in this study in mice, the normal interaction between motor cortical regions and the auditory cortex is for the motor cortical input to suppress. the auditory cortex. And that's
just to say, when I feel my jaws moving, I tell the auditory part of my brain, slow it down.
Right. So one could imagine if that suppression has not occurred, that there'd be a sensation of something happening or something more happening than would normally be registered.
John, is there anything in this research that holds out a promise for treatment for schizophrenics, do you think?
I think so. And there are some emerging treatments that are looking at direct intervention on these regions. And one is transcranial magnetic stimulation, where you can use a magnetic field to stimulate or suppress a cortical region. And there is some evidence now that people who have treatment-resistant auditory hallucinations can benefit from this kind of a treatment.
And how would that work? What would be going on in that case?
I don't know the details of it, but it is you're stimulating prefrontal areas and I think the auditory regions, and the idea is that these regions are talking to each other. Mm. And there's a lot of interest now in these cortical rhythms that different regions of the brain are synchronously active, and so one region knows what the other one is, and it's all timed together. So it may be that, you know, along the lines of his research is the coordination of activity is mistimed, and one of the ideas about this is the stimulation is you're bringing it back into good coordinated activity.
Does it have implications for a kind of a cognitive therapy, that is an awareness of what's going on, to train the brain, those regions of the brain, to talk to each other in a better way, to talk in a more organized way? Could through a form of meditation or through some kind of practice, an intellectual or cognitive practice, train the brain to kind of get it right and talk, you know, more sensibly to each other?
I think that's possible. And there is definitely more traditional cognitive behavioral therapies for people who have persistent auditory hallucinations as well. And it's more to kind of recognize this is a hallucination. How am I going to respond to it? What am I going to do about it? And that does tend to improve the hallucinations over time.
Rich, what are the implications for your work, do you think, beyond the treatment of schizophrenia?
It relates directly to how the motor system prepares the sensory system for what's going to happen. And at its core is the ability to predict consequences of planned movement. That, I think, is really a fundamentally fascinating problem that the brain solves all the time in really mundane ways and also really elegant ways, depending on the behavior we're engaged in. But I think that, you know, for us, the next step is to understand whether or not there's a predictive signal embedded in this motor cortical to auditory cortical interaction. And we're trying to test whether or not when the animal generates certain stereotype sounds, for example, vocalization, does the signal act in a very spatial and temporal way to suppress the expected vocal output from the vocal organ? And, you know, related to this and, you know, getting to this issue of damping and then heightened excitation, I mean, why dampen the response to what we think is going to happen? Because through practice, our brain learns that's what's likely to happen. If it can cancel that out, it can detect errors in performance, which is hugely beneficial for learning, and also keep the sensory system highly attuned to other signals in the environment that aren't the consequence of one's own actions.
Yeah, so the good news in all that is, for instance, you could start, if you got control of this, you wouldn't have as many typos, because clearly you got it the second you made you typed the T instead of the R. Well, if you knew that's where you were going, why didn't you stop me in the first place, right? I mean, I've asked my little brain that, and it doesn't have a good answer. And I wonder if this has any implication for that kind of thing.
Well, and that's another interesting dimension of this. I mean, why do we make mistakes? Even when we're highly practiced, we speak every day. We're still, our fluency is a challenge, even when we're talking just, you know, quietly off to the side, let alone on the radio. But, you know, a little motor variation is a good thing. And you know, having that variation allows you to explore and learn to create new behaviors. So you want some, but you want to also detect when you go away from a goal, or what you would like to accomplish.
That allows for plasticity in human behavior. You make a few mistakes. Some of them are good mistakes. And in any event, as Ibsen said, you have to write a bad play before you write a good one. So I guess that's part of who we are. Well, I want to thank you both for being on the program today. Richard Mooney is a neurobiologist at Duke University School of Medicine. John Gilmore, vice chair for research and scientific affairs at the Department of Psychiatry at UNC Chapel Hill. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And if you want more information, go to our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we'll examine internet access in rural communities. Stay tuned.